Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. We're looking forward to spending some time today talking about a significant part of the world, and one where the gospel has made amazing advances. It was in early June, in fact, June 4, 1989, that there was the world maybe took notice of an uprising in China. We learned the word the Tiananmen Square. We're going to talk about that and more today. Looking forward to reconnecting here on Connecting Faith with Brent Fulton. Brent's president of China Source and the editor of the China Source Quarterly and a number of the publications that they produce. Prior to that, he served as managing director of the Institute for Chinese Studies at Wheaton College. He has been our guest in the past, and we always appreciate the opportunity to connect with him. Not too long ago, he and Louise Bush put together a book summarizing some of what's going on in China. They call it China's Next Generation, New China, New Church, and New World. And we'll touch on all aspects of that. But, Brent, first of all, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Neil. Great to be with you.
We remember 26 years ago a protest came to a head in Tiananmen Square. I'm interested if you can just maybe talk a little about, when it happened, why it happened. And I know you were in, Hong Kong the day it did happen, right?
I was. I vividly remember that day. It had been building, actually, for a few years. There had been student protests going on in different parts of China, protesting corruption within the government, protesting growing economic inequality as China was embarking on economic reforms, and pointing out, as many intellectuals did during that time, that in order to have real reform, you needed to have political reform, not just economic reform. And all of those things came to a head when Hu Yaobang, who had been a general secretary of the Communist Party and had been booted out of that position, died the spring of 1989. And people turned out en masse to commemorate Hu Yaobang, who they saw as a real reformer. And the government was uneasy with that, obviously, tried to bring the protests under control. But it was interesting that even within the government, there was a lot of ambivalence about it. I remember we were subscribing to a publication put out by the party for outside consumption. It was an English language publication. And a couple of weeks before June 4th, we got it in the mail, and on the cover was a picture of Tiananmen Square and people protesting. And it was actually a kind of an interesting take on, wow, there's people from all walks of life out here. It's not just students. There's people all from, all different business and government and education. They're all out here. Well, it's a biweekly publication. 2 weeks later, didn't come out. And by the time we got it again, it was after June 4th, and the tone had completely changed. It was all about how the government had to quell this counter-revolutionary protest that was going on in Beijing. So the tone had completely flipped. So I think it pointed out that even within the highest level of government, and we know this today, that even within the highest level of government, people were at odds about how to deal with this. Should they really try to move ahead with reform, or should they just quell it?
And was it primarily students that were leading it, or was it, people from all walks of life?
Well, it was the students in the square. They were the ones that were leading the charge, so to speak. They were the ones hunger striking. They were the ones demanding to meet with officials, which some of them ended up being able to do. But as the students became under attack, you saw other people getting involved. Even people from the official seminary down in Nanjing showed up in the square with a big cross. As the government or as the military moved in, then all kinds of townspeople were in the streets trying to keep the military away and try to protect the students. So it wasn't just the students.
Talk about maybe would the government have reacted differently today, or were the reforms that were fought for then, have they actually come into place?
Well, the economic reforms, of course, have continued and resulted in China's huge economic growth, unprecedented in history. Political reform really has not happened the way people hoped back in 1989. There was legislation on the books back then that was just shelved and has never been seen since that would have changed the way the government deals with, among other things, religion in China, but many other issues as well. Today, if you go to Beijing, anywhere near Tiananmen Square, on every street corner, you will see armed police, and you will see police vans. It would be impossible for any group of any size to gather anywhere near Tiananmen Square. They would be taken down within minutes.
Would that be similar across the entire nation of China? So is there, I mean, that sounds sort of, you know, like police presence is pretty strong. So.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, no. There have been thousands of smaller protests across China every year for the last several years. I forget the exact number, but they've grown. For example, in Guangzhou recently, there was a pretty large it's actually in Guangdong province, not in Guangzhou city proper, but there was a fairly large demonstration of people protesting. I think it was over a land dispute, government taking over land that people were not happy about. That's quite common in China, as local governments have seen selling land as a way of making money and have colluded with developers to take over people's land. And that has resulted in many protests that we never hear about. They're usually not in the news, but they're happening around the country. Now, of course, those protests eventually are put down by the police. But it is interesting how large they can get at times.
Give us a sense maybe of the political, I guess, the temperature in the nation today. What do we not know about China, or are our perceptions right about China?
Well, we have a fairly new leader. Xi Jinping came into power a couple of years ago, and people have said he's the most powerful leader since Mao. He has consolidated all the major divisions of government under himself, and he's unleashed an anti-corruption campaign that has brought down hundreds of officials, some of them going to trial even now. And so people would generally point to a tightening in society under Xi. He's all about control. He's all about rule by law, which means that everybody has to be their activities have to be ordered and controlled by law. And so he's really been pushing legal reform in almost every area of society. So on the one hand, you could point to tightening. On the other hand, though, Xi is promoting what's often called the China Dream, which is a strong and prosperous China that's able to stand up to the rest of the world. And China has certainly been exerting its energies in international political realm, such as the UN and other bodies, ASEAN. And they've certainly been exercising their military clout in the South China Sea, making some of their neighbors a little bit nervous. So all of that, I think, for people in China, kind of bolsters their self-esteem and says, you know, China's standing up to the rest of the world. We are a prosperous nation with a long history and a lot to be proud of. And so I think inside China, many people respect Xi Jinping a lot for kind of raising China's profile, if you will, and making China feel better about itself.
Has there been that attitude that China was sort of second class or second rate, do you think, I mean, in terms of the global view?
Well, there's been a narrative within China. It's the 100 years of humiliation that China suffered at the hands of the European and the American powers for so long. It was only after the Communist Party came in 1949 that China began to, you know, kind of come into its own again, and it's taken many decades to do. But now China is at a point where it can go toe-to-toe with these world powers. And for the Chinese that have been fed this narrative of 100 years of humiliation for so long, this is really something to be able to be at this status.
Brent Fulton is my guest today. Brent is president of China Source, editor of the China Source Quarterly. They have a number of publications. He's co-authored a helpful resource book called China's Next Generation, New China, New Church, New World. We're going to talk more about the church and maybe just some of the amazing growth and some of what's going on in China today as we get an expert update. And I always appreciate that. Checking with Brent Fulton today on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're glad to have connected with Brent Fulton, president of China Source. Prior to that, Brent was managing director of the Institute for Chinese Studies at Wheaton College. He has watched and observed China for years and provides us some keen insight on that. We're grateful for the opportunity to get an update today on that. I was interested if there's a, and when you speak of China, is there sort of an overarching philosophy or summary that capsulizes the nation? We think, well, I guess in the United States, it's all about freedom, right? Maybe personal responsibility. What are some of these kind of underlying guidelines maybe for China?
Mm-hmm. I think maybe one of the ethos of the Chinese people in China today is just the glory of the Chinese nation. They would look back in history at the Ming Dynasty, for example, and see a time when China was the world's largest economy and was inventing all kinds of things that we take for granted today and was intellectually very powerful. And they would say, you know, this is who we are. We have a right to be all of these things today. And so our economic development as a nation, our increased status internationally, our ability to receive awards on the world scene for various things, certainly hosting the Olympics in 2008, and they hope to host the Winter Olympics down the road as well. All of these things are part of regaining their glory as a nation.
Well, and they certainly, in terms of what technology and some of those things, I mean, it's truly amazing, right?
It is.
What they're doing.
Yeah, the economic growth you've seen in China and just the modernization. I mean, you look at the subways in the major cities, the new airports that are being built, and then the high-speed train. You know, their vision is link the whole country together with high-speed rail, link China to the world with high-speed rail. That's just been going great guns. I don't think any other country has modernized that fast and at that scale than China has.
But a fairly probably a growing divergence of sort of the modernization and the maybe the peasantry too, right? I mean, mm-hmm. there's talk about. So I mean, China is not just one sort of homogenous, I guess, nation, is it?
No, China's always been a mixture. People would say, well, there are actually many Chinas. There are the borderland Chinas, you know, Southwest China bordering Vietnam, Cambodia, Burma. You've got the far west where you've got Muslim peoples. You've got the north, you've got the Mongols, people of Russian ancestry, and then the northeast, you've got the Koreans. So if you look all around China, you have a very diverse population of many different minorities. And then you've got the difference between the cities and the countryside. If you've been to a big city in China, you've been to a big city in China, but you haven't seen China. Still, it's less than 50% now, but still there's a lot of people in the countryside. And their level of development, their standard of living, would be vastly different from that of people in the cities. I remember having lunch in a very nice hotel, I guess about 10 years ago in Beijing. And I was with a group that was visiting from America. And a friend who was living in southwest China, a Chinese brother, came up to see us. And we were sitting at this lunch buffet together, and we realized that one of us were paying more for lunch that day than the people he hangs out with in southwest China earn in an entire year. And just the huge gap there, it can be mind-blowing if you think about it.
We've heard about, of course, the migration to the cities. I mean, one of the greatest urban migrations ever, right?
Ever, yeah. Right. And so, in a sense, that's kind of narrowing the gap because you have a lot of people who were peasants. Now they're in the cities. We would probably refer to them as the rural community in the cities. They're not quite – this. You know, the generation that migrated is not quite city people yet. In fact, because of the hukou or the household registration system in China, they are still considered rural people, even though they live in the city. So they're not entitled to the benefits that city people get. But their children now that are being born in the city are growing up in the city and demanding a better life than their parents had. And so you have this kind of cultural migration now of the next generation of rural people who have migrated to the cities.
Does that create some tension? I mean, for a rural person coming in and not finding the prosperity they're hoping for?
Oh, huge tension. When it comes to housing, healthcare, education, all of those things have basically been denied the migrants. Yet everybody would say, well, we need the migrants. You know, without the migrants, the Bird's Nest Stadium, the Water Cube, all of the wonderful venues we saw in the 2008 Olympics would not have been built. None of the big skyscrapers you see in major cities in China today would even be there were it not for the migrants. So they know they need them. But yet they've been loath to give them the benefits that urban people enjoy. And in fact, in some cities now, they're actually taking measures to push them out. In a sense, okay, you've done what you came to do, but we don't have room for you. We're going to push you out. Well, their children then who were have grown up in the city are saying, wait a minute. We want to go to school, too. We want to get a better job than our parents ever had. We want to stay here. So that is creating a lot of tension. Politically, there's a huge tension over what to do about the household registration system. Do you keep this system that's been in place since the 50s, which says rural people and urban people are totally different and they have different rights? Or do you abolish that and say, we are becoming an urban society and let's just let it happen and let's acknowledge everybody is having rights? That's something that is being hashed out in the government, and there may be a breakthrough in that in the next couple of years.
Would you ever see China sort of dividing up like the Balkans, where there's the sort of Muslim West or the Mongol North or that sort of thing?
You know, culturally, it's conceivable that it could happen. And throughout history, China has gained and lost different parts of its territory, particularly on the periphery. That is got to be very fresh in the minds of any leader of China who's thinking, really, how do I keep this together? And so when you see, for example, Tibetans out in the West protesting, Muslims becoming radicalized, which some of which are happening in China, all of those things really at this point just caused the party to batten down the hatches and increase Han Chinese migration into those areas, increase the police presence, and do everything they can to keep it together. Because throughout history, there has been this potential of some of these groups wanting to go off on their own.
You know, we talked a little bit about just the young people coming to the cities, wanting a better life than their parents. Talk about the young in China. I mean, what can you describe, sort of, what are their passions? I mean, is the youth movement the same no matter where you are around the globe?
Well, in some ways, yes. You know, the fashions can be very similar. They love Korean soap operas and Taiwan pop stars. But for most young people in China, their life is built around taking tests because there's incredible competition to get into university. And the whole education system in China, really from kindergarten on up, is about getting into a better school and testing so you can move up into a better school and better grades and eventually being able to take that college entrance exam, which all the young people hope to take, and being one of the, few that actually get into university. Now, the number of students in university has greatly increased in the last 20 years as more universities have been built and more positions have been opened up and such. But there's still that competition. And so on the one hand, young people may have great dreams of making money, being successful, having a family, enjoying themselves. On the other hand, there's this pressure from their parents and everybody in their family and their teachers. Oh, you just got to study. You've got to take these tests and you've got to do well. And it creates really a dissonance, I think, within the minds of young people. For these tests, they also kind of retreat into the virtual world of online gaming and online chats. It's kind of an escape from that.
Are the issues, maybe the pressures they're facing, the same as their parents' generation, 25, 26 mm-hmm. years ago, the protests in Tiananmen? I mean, those were students there as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think this generation is a lot less political than that previous generation. The government has done a very good job of educating young people that you don't mess with politics and you respect the government. I think Tiananmen was a wake-up call for the party that unless they really buckle down and work on the young people, they might lose them. So, and the cost of being, right now, even the cost of just speaking your mind, if you have a political opinion, is so high that I think young people have been just kind of inoculated against doing that. They just don't go there. And at the same time, like I said before, China is regaining its former glory, and there's a lot of economic opportunity for young people. And so they're thinking, why would I want to do what my parents' generation might have done? I can get a good job. I can work hard. I can get into university. Maybe I can go abroad. And so there's always these things that attract them, which are very practical things.
The cost of politics is high. We have assumed, I guess, rightly or wrongly, and maybe it's been different over the years, that the cost of following Christ is high in China as well. Let's talk a little about the church.
In terms of the cost, I would say that over the past two decades or so, the cost has, in a sense, not been as high. The religious policy in China has not changed since 1982. And the religious policy is fairly, on paper, it's fairly restrictive. People can only worship within the four walls of a church, and that church has to be registered with the government. In reality, there's this huge gray area that continues to open up where people are meeting in unregistered venues. Used to be just in homes. Now you've got groups in the cities that are not registered that are renting office spaces and meeting in the same place on Sundays and maybe have hundreds of people in attendance and have very nice facilities. And the government, by and large, except for a few cases, has turned a blind eye towards those and said, okay, fine, you're doing that. Just, you know, we know where you are. We know who you are. Don't get political and don't get too big. There's over 1,000 Christian titles that have been published legally in China and sold in bookstores. The Bible is still somewhat restricted. You can only buy it through official channels. But Christian publishing has really opened up. And then in the last decade, the Internet has just exploded. There's, for all the talk about the great firewall that we hear, how China tries to keep things out of the Internet, there is an incredible amount of Christian material being generated within China on church websites, worship websites, all kinds of different chat rooms. Last year, somebody counted 7 different Christian dating sites online in China. So that whole area has just exploded. And, you know, with that, it's a lot easier for people to go to church, and in a sense, it's a lot more normal for people to go to church. The registered churches in the cities are full, and it's no longer just older people going. It's younger people who are really spiritually hungry, and they're going. The unregistered churches as well. And interestingly, even in the secular media the last couple of years, there have been a number of articles just talking about Christians in China in a very matter-of-fact way. Saying, these are Christians. Here's how, for example, they celebrate Easter. Here's how they celebrate Christmas. Here's why. Not putting them down, but just kind of saying, well, this is what Christians do. In that environment, in a sense, there's less of a cost because it's becoming more socially acceptable to be a Christian.
Well, we'll pick up the conversation more in a moment. We need to take a break, and we're getting a good firsthand report on what's happening in China, understanding this nation and the church there. We'll focus more on the church here in the moments ahead as we talk with Brent Fulton, president of China Source, and the editor of China Source Quarterly. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're focusing today on China and particularly how the church is growing and developing there. We've talked a little bit about the economic and the political growth and remembering back to Tiananmen Square back in June 4 of 1989 and some of the protests around that. Getting good perspective today from Brent Fulton. Brent is the president of China Source, the editor of China Source Quarterly. In fact, they have a number of resources available that we'll make sure to talk on here about in just a moment. But Brent, we're talking a little bit about the church and how there seems to be freedom to do at least in some places. Just it's become more normal, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. Well, clearly the church has had some influence, right? I mean, if it's growing to 50 to 100 million, I mean, there's a huge number of Christians. They must have some influence somewhere, I think.
They do, and they have. And I think getting back to Tiananmen, one of the legacies of that really was a spiritual awakening among many young people who were totally disillusioned after June 4th. And that disillusionment led them on a spiritual search, and many became believers. Today you can point to pastors in China and outside China, people leading Christian organizations outside China, who would trace their own conversions back to that experience. And many of those are influential people. You know, I can think of university professors who are believers. I can think of influential pastors in China who are believers because of that particular incident.
Is there talking more about the influence of Christianity? Is it we maybe assume that it was an underground movement of perhaps peasants a generation ago? That's not really the case now, though.
There's been a tremendous transition, and I would say that the spiritual center of gravity has shifted from the countryside, where you saw incredible revival, signs and wonders in the 80s, to now to the cities, where you have a new kind of a church emerging. You know, the leaders, the members are probably more cosmopolitan, they're better educated, they have a different status in society. And this, in a sense, has elevated the church's status when they see these kinds of people leading the church or these kinds of people attending the church. It says something about the church. It's no longer a marginalized peasant movement. It's very much part of what's going on in China, in urban China.
Is there interest? I mean, because obviously there's a lot of pursuit about education, economic development. So does religion, or at least Christianity, does it fit in with the goals and objectives of the average Chinese person?
Yeah, that's a great question. In the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of talk among intellectuals about the relationship between Christianity and the development of Western nations. And people were drawing parallels and saying, you know, this is what China needs. We're lacking this faith, and therefore we're not able to move ahead economically and in other ways. There was a whole group of intellectuals, they were called the cultural Christians back in the 80s and 90s. And they didn't necessarily profess faith. They didn't necessarily go to church, but they had a very strong affinity with Christianity because of its involvement historically in the development of societies. I don't see that as much today. I think the government certainly is pushing more of a secular viewpoint, and the idea that Christianity and development go together necessarily, the Christian faith is essential for development as a nation, is not being put forward as much. There are still intellectuals, though, that would strongly believe that without the Christian faith and the ethic that it brings in so many ways, that China will be stunted in its development and that it's necessary for China to move ahead.
So to address, I guess, those issues that we talked about earlier in terms of the legal side and the corruption, addressing mm-hmm. corruption, I mean, you need to have some sort of moral framework and from which to address that.
Exactly. And there's a prominent sociologist in Beijing who's a believer, and he's written extensively, including in the official press, about China's lack of faith. He calls it a crisis of faith. Up until Mao, China always had somebody to believe in and somebody to tell them what to believe. After Mao died, that was gone. Deng Xiaoping came into power and he said, to get rich is glorious. Everybody just go make money and we'll be fine. He never told people what to believe. Communist Party has been unable to tell people what to believe for the last 35 years. So now people are realizing making money and being successful is not it. There's something else missing in our society. And that's why we have so much corruption. That's why we can't trust each other. That's why we can't even buy food knowing that it's really what it is, what it says on the package. There's been so many food scandals in China. All of these things are symptoms of just a total lack of trust in society. And people are saying, yeah, we do need – there is a crisis of belief. We need something to base our lives on, and we don't have it. I think that for the church is a huge opportunity to be able to say, yes, our society has deep problems, and here's why, and give the explanation for that.
And is that maybe an important inroad in terms of the gospel? I guess we think of, you know, over the course of centuries and various people groups – mm-hmm. You know, there have been different sort of entrees into the gospel. What resonates, I guess?
I think for China, the crisis of faith certainly is that. In the business world, for example, corruption is taken for granted. And if you have a Christian business leader who says, I'm going to deal with my customers and my employees differently, I'm going to pay my taxes, I'm not going to give bribes, well, one response would be, are you going to stay in business? But another response is, this is really what we need. You know, you're bold. You're willing to make this step and do things differently. You know, and if in a family, a husband and wife who agree to, who commit to remain faithful to each other, you know, as believers. That sets a huge example in the society. Neighbors who go out of their way to care for each other, which in China is very rare, that sets a huge example. So there's opportunities for Christians through their lives to put forward a different standard because of who they are as believers. And that addresses this whole problem of crisis of faith, of not being able to trust each other.
Which is rare for families to care for someone outside their family? Expand on that a little bit more.
In China, there's an idiom in Chinese, and it means you only sweep the snow in front of your own front door. In other words, you don't get involved in your neighbor's stuff unless you have some sort of a family connection to them. Everybody takes care of themselves and their family networks. And so even in the whole idea of charity or philanthropy in China, which is beginning to take off, it's hard because in China you don't have a tradition of caring for people who you don't know. You care for people within your family circles, your family connections, maybe people who you knew through school or work connections because you have a connection to them. But to care for a total stranger, that's not part of the Chinese tradition. So when in 2008, for example, when the Sichuan earthquake happened and you had Christians coming from all over the place to Sichuan to help in the rescue efforts and then the redevelopment efforts, that was a real turning point for the church. And it made a statement to the society that Christians care for people, period. And really was a challenge, I think, to the society.
Are there mission opportunities? I mean, the missionaries but haven't been allowed in China for many years, right? So where, I mean, you were talking a little bit about business. I know there's pretty strategic business as mission operations going on. But what's effective maybe in terms of reaching into China, or does it happen kind of from the outside through, you know, mission radio or something?
Well, in many ways, China's being reached by Chinese. You know, you look at the explosive growth of the church, unprecedented in history, and you kind of say, well, that all happened from within inside. So what can we do? There are opportunities for business and professional people from outside to have a witness through their relationships. I think right now modeling is one of the most important things for people from outside who end up living in China. It's not so much transmitting your knowledge, because many believers in China are very well educated, even in biblical things. But it's more of how do you live your life? What does it mean to be a parent and a Christian? What does it mean to be a boss and a Christian? Or what does it mean to be a professor and a Christian? And really, it's more what you do than what you say. I think that those who go over to China with that attitude and just live their lives in a very humble way are leaving behind an incredible legacy for the church, because there's really a lack of role models in the urban church, but for the larger society as well. Living out what does it mean to be a Christian. So certainly there are many opportunities to do that.
So is teaching English still an effective way to just to go and engage in the Chinese culture?
It certainly is. It's gotten harder because the education system has gotten more stringent in terms of who can come. So you have to have experience. In some cases, you have to have an advanced degree to come and teach English in China. Whereas in past decades, if you had a college degree and you were an American, fine. It's no longer that easy. But certainly there are positions. Increasingly, there are private schools, private high schools, and even private elementary schools that are looking for a foreign teacher. And so that's a whole new area of opportunity for the foreigner who wants to go live in China.
Getting a fresh perspective today on China with Brent Fulton, president of China Source, editor of China Source Quarterly. I'll talk a little about the Chinese dispersion and some of the mission outreach from China coming back west. We'll get to that and more coming up in just a moment. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We've enjoyed our time today with Brent Fulton, kind enough to be in the studio today and give us a perspective on China. Brent is the president of China Source, editor of the China Source Quarterly, and has also co-written a book called China's Next Generation, New China, New Church, New World. And we kind of joke sometimes about the Americans, you know, with this as much money loaned to China, we should probably all learn to speak Chinese. But, I mean, it probably wouldn't hurt us to learn some rudimentary Chinese anyway, right? Just as an opportunity to maybe connect with the international students, which are many come from China, right?
Oh, to our doors. Certainly, yeah.
Talk about the the Chinese coming to our doors and maybe just how we might have some influence and just develop some relationships there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chinese traditionally have been a very large percentage of the international students coming to the States. I think the incoming freshman class at Purdue a couple of years ago was about 25% people from China. So that gives you one example of, and in the Twin Cities, actually, the University of Minnesota has traditionally had a very, very large contingent of students from China. It's been going on really since the early 80s, and I think it is an incredible opportunity to reach people at a point where they are open to new ideas, and they're exploring what is this culture that they've now entered, and why do these people do what they do? And it's often the hospitality and just the caring and the community that the church provides, which is an incredible witness to people from China. But along with that, now comes the kind of the next generation of this whole phenomenon, which is high school students. More and more parents in China, because they're fed up with the test-taking mentality of education in China today, and they want their children to have a better opportunity for the future and to really, get a better quality education. They've decided that they're not going to go that route in China. They're going to have their child come to high school in the States and then prepare for college in the States. And so you have now tens of thousands of Chinese high school students coming to the United States. And for Christian high schools in the United States, this is a great opportunity to reach out to them, put them into Christian families and let them see what Christian families look like and get them involved in a church and provide an education from a biblical worldview, which they're not going to get in China. For many Christian parents in China, actually, this would be a preferred alternative if they could afford it, have their child come and go to high school in the United States. It's more challenging in some ways than reaching out to college students because they're at a different place in their lives. But for families that are willing to host these students in their homes, I think it's a great opportunity.
Brent, we've heard about the Back to Jerusalem movement, and I know there's a huge dispersed Chinese population around the globe. In fact, mm-hmm. I mean, the Chinese populations are having significant influence in worldwide, aren't they? I mean, they're heavily invested in Africa and all. I mean, just everywhere.
They are everywhere. Yeah, and interestingly, just recently I was at a conference and a professor who studied the Chinese diaspora and the Chinese church diaspora was giving a talk on this. He himself is from China and he's a Christian. And he put up this map and it was a map of the world and there was a red dot everywhere he knew of a Chinese Christian community. And there were red dots everywhere. And he talked about visiting with Chinese believers in Italy and Paris and Amsterdam and different places in Africa, South America. So it's true. Everywhere, I mean, the Chinese tend to be going everywhere these days. And you find Christian communities popping up in all these different places.
And are they having maybe influence that a North American probably wouldn't be able to have, right, in terms of their sharing mm-hmm. their faith or living it out, perhaps?
Potentially, yes, because in many cases, a Chinese person would be more culturally acceptable than a Westerner, particularly an American, because of political baggage that Americans would bring. I think the challenge, though, is we think about China's outreach to the rest of the world and the idea that China would be a mission-sending country, is that you have to remember that most Chinese believers are Han Chinese. That's the majority people in China, 95% of the population is Han Chinese. Most of them have lived their Christian life totally in a Han Chinese context, Chinese speaking, Chinese thinking. And even though China has many minority peoples, even within its borders, most Christians have not really interacted with those peoples. So even when you see Chinese going abroad to all these different places, often what you see are Chinese communities starting Chinese churches in Chinese. And so the actual cross-cultural outreach is not readily taking place, it's going to take concerted effort and equipping to be able to do that. That's the challenge I see for the mission movement from China.
So talk about the maybe the concerted effort, the training, the equipping that's needed. You mentioned that you know many Chinese are well-educated mm-hmm. now. So what's the most effective role perhaps for the Western church to play?
Well, you know, the churches outside of China, of course, have a long history and have learned a lot in terms of mission sending. And so I think there's an opportunity for the international organizations to come alongside the Chinese church and maybe just incorporate them in small numbers into international teams in different parts of the world and give them a flavor of, you know, what is it like to work as part of a team of people from other countries and then to work in a culture that's not your own. And let them learn by observing and by doing together. There has been a fair amount of effort being put into study within China or even taking groups of people outside China, giving them cross-cultural training, language training, comparative religion, things like that. And all of that's really important. But at the end of the day, they have to be able to live and work and function in another culture. And that takes a behavioral change and it takes a heart change. It's not something you can learn in a classroom. So I think learning together, the international organization and the Chinese church, is where that's going to happen.
You mentioned that, you know, back in the 80s, there was much of the church growing in rural areas, signs and wonders. Would that still describe maybe the church today in terms of their theology perspective?
It's interesting. There's certainly a stream within the Church of China, much of it with rural roots, that would still see the Lord working in those ways and expect the Lord to work in those ways. You also have another stream, and I don't want to paint this as, you know, two totally different streams, but maybe two different sides of the coin, if you will, an intellectual community of Christians that has really gravitated to the Reformed tradition. And has, in a sense, tended to downplay the role of signs and wonders and miracles, not discounting them, but saying, you know, we don't want our people just to be superstitious. We don't want our people just to believe because somebody got healed. And they would maybe say that in the countryside there was a very thin line between traditional folk religion and the power encounters that you saw there and what you saw going on in the church. And so they would say, we need to be better educated in the Bible. We need to be better grounded theologically in order to really be strong as a church. And so you kind of see these different emphases in the cities.
You mentioned a huge effort online where Christians are using that forum to mm-hmm. To evangelize, I assume, to share testimonies, probably to teach. So are there training opportunities? I mean, talk a little bit about what that looks like in, mm-hmm. in China.
Well, in terms of training, there's some interesting things happening. Actually, seminaries in America are offering online degrees. They've been doing it for years. And so students can go online, take classes, and then I think in the best situations, they actually have mentors on the ground who they would meet with face-to-face and work through their material that way as well. But it certainly helped in terms of content delivery and being able to access theological training. So that would be kind of at the seminary level. And then you have a lot of informal training being offered, video training. There's at least a couple Chinese Christian TV stations, if you will, on the Internet. And they're offering all kinds of speakers in Chinese from all over the world. So that gives the Chinese church a window into the thinking of the Chinese church around the world. There's also, of course, sermons being posted by churches. I heard of one registered church now that's getting ready to stream their services online, live on their website. Devotionals. And then in China, the mobile platform, I think, has taken off a lot more quickly than here in America. And so many Chinese would be accessing the web almost exclusively from their smartphone. There are many people who never owned a computer, but they're online because they have a smartphone. And so text messaging, short messaging, getting the word out that way has become very important. So you've got devotionals that are going out every morning on SMS, and a lot of things happening on WeChat, which is kind of the equivalent of a Twitter here in America. People communicating with each other on a number of different topics. There's all kinds of groups that have been formed around various Christian topics people are interacting on.
You provide some good opportunities for us to stay connected with the church in China, what's going on. Say a little bit about China Source and and some of the resources, the things that you're doing. Maybe, you know, why the organization, what's your focus?
Well, traditionally, we've been a catalyst, helping to bring together different organizations and churches to work effectively in China. We believe that we're called to work as a body. We're called to work in partnership. And China Sources have the privilege over the years of helping people figure out how to do that. One of the ways we do that is sharing information. Back in the 90s, when China Source first got going, there was a lot happening in terms of ministry in China, but people were very reticent to talk about it. And so you'd have organizations learning all kinds of wonderful things, but it didn't get shared for security reasons and for other reasons. And we felt that if we could just be learning from each other, we'd all be doing a better job. And so through our website, through the China Source Quarterly, we've been attempting to help people have a platform where they can share what they're doing and what they're learning. And then in more recent years, we've really sensed that given the maturation of the Chinese church, which still faces many restrictions and many pressures, but in many ways has really come into its own, we need to be listening to them. We need to be taking our cues from them and really getting a handle. What do they feel they need, and how can we as outsiders best serve them? And so that's why we started something called Chinese Church Voices, where we dip into all this conversation that's happening on the Internet in China. We pick out some of it, and we translate it into English so that people outside China can get a sense of what this conversation is like. What are the big issues that Chinese Christians are talking about? Where are the areas where they feel that they need to engage with the church outside China? And so on our website, chinasource.org, we have a section called Chinese Church Voices where we feature that. And the whole reason is we need to be listening to the church in China.
We've not always been very good at listening in the West. We could learn a lot, though, from our brothers and sisters in Christ.
I think we can, yes.
ChinaSource.org is the website. I encourage you to check it out for the resources, whether it's their online publications or the China Source Quarterly, or as we talked about, the China Church Voice, Chinese Church Voices. You can find out more. There's a number of opportunities and ways to connect if you go online, ChinaSource.org. Brent Fulton, president of China Source. Brent, how would you, just maybe in a minute we have left, what would be maybe the best way for us to pray for the church in China? Is there one thing that comes to mind?
You know, people have talked about the incredible growth of the church in China and what that might mean for the future, not only of China, but for China's impact on the world, because China is impacting the world. And I often come back to, is it just the number of Christians, or is it really the quality of those Christians, how they live their lives and how they engage? And I think especially in the urban church, the church has unprecedented opportunities to impact families and society in many different ways. But they've never been there before. They've never been down this road. And so just pray for a lot of discernment and wisdom to know how to be good stewards of the many opportunities they've been entrusted with at a time when China is in transition. And how the church responds today has huge implications for the future.
Brent Fulton, president of China Source, editor of the China Source Quarterly, and that's to join us today on Connecting Faith. Brent, always good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Neil.